Maybe she's just trying to save you from getting into trouble for talking with a stranger. I still don't like keeping it secret from him, Phoebe said. We walked out onto her porch, and there, lying on the top step, was a white envelope. There was no name or anything on the outside. I thought it was one of those advertisements for painting your house or cleaning your carpets. Phoebe opened it. Gosh, she said. Inside was a small piece of blue paper, and on it was printed this message. Don't judge a man until you've walked 2 moons in his moccasins. What an odd thing, Phoebe said. When Phoebe showed the message to her mother, Mrs. Winterbottom clutched at her collar. Who could it be for? Mrs. Winterbottom asked. Mr. Winterbottom came in the back door carrying his golf clubs. Look, George, Mrs. Winterbottom said. Who could this be for?
Well, I couldn't say, really, Mr. Winterbottom said.
But, George, why would someone send us that message?
I couldn't say, Norma. Maybe it isn't for us.
Not for us, Mrs. Winterbottom said. But it was on our steps.
Really, Norma, it could be for anyone. Maybe it's for Prudence or Phoebe.
Phoebe? Mrs. Winterbottom asked. Is it for you?
For me, Phoebe said. I don't think so.
Well, who is it for? Mrs. Winterbottom said. She was awfully worried. I believe she thought it came from the potential lunatic. Chapter 10. Huzzah, huzzah. I had just finished telling Graham and Gramps about the mysterious message when Gramps pulled off the freeway. He said he was tired of chewing up the road, and the white lines down the middle of the highway were starting to wiggle. As he drove into Madison, Wisconsin, Graham said,
I feel a little sorry for Mrs. Winterbottom. She doesn't sound very happy.
They all sound screwy, if you ask me, Gramps said.
Being a mother is like trying to hold a wolf by the ears, Graham said. If you have 3 or 4 or more chickabiddies, you're dancing on a hot griddle all the time. You don't have time to think about anything else. And if you've only got 1 or 2, it's almost harder. You have room left over, empty spaces that you think you've got to fill up.
Well, it sure ain't a cinch being a father either, Graham said.
Graham touched his arm. Horse feathers, she said. Round and round we drove until Gramps saw a parking space. Another car saw it, too, but Gramps was fast and pulled in, and when the man in the other car waved his fist, Gramps said,
I'm a veteran! See this leg? Shrapnel from German guns! I saved our country!
We did not have the correct change for the parking meter, so Gramps wrote a long note about how he was a visitor from Bybanks, Kentucky, and he was a World War II veteran with German shrapnel in his leg, and he kindly appreciated the members of the fair city of Madison allowing him to park in this space even though he did not have the correct change for the meter. He put this note on the dashboard. Do you really have German shrapnel in your leg? I asked. Gramps looked up at the sky.
Mighty nice day, he said.
The shrapnel was imaginary. Sometimes I am a little slow to figure these things out. My father once said I was as gullible as a fish. I thought he said edible. I thought he meant I was tasty. The city of Madison sprawls between 2 lakes, Lake Mendota and Lake Monona, and dribbling out of these are other piddly lakes. It seemed as if the whole city was on vacation, with people riding around on their bikes and walking along the lakes and feeding the ducks and eating and canoeing and windsurfing. I'd never seen anything like it. Graham kept saying, huzzah, huzzah. There's a part of the city where no cars can go, and thousands of people stroll around eating ice cream. We went into Ella's Kosher Deli and Ice Cream Parlor and ate pastrami sandwiches and kosher dill pickles followed by raspberry ice cream. After we walked around some more, we were hungry again, so we had lemon tea and blueberry muffins at the Steep and Brew. All the while, I heard the whispers. Rush, hurry, rush. Graham and Gramps moved so slowly. Shouldn't we go now? I kept asking, but Graham would say,
"Huzzah, huzzah."
And Gramps would say, "We'll go soon, Chickabiddy, soon."
"Don't you want to send any postcards?"
Gram asked.
"No, I do not." "Not even to your daddy?"
"No." There was a good reason for this. All along her trip, my mother had sent me postcards. She wrote, "Here I am in the Badlands, missing you terribly." And, "This is Mount Rushmore, but I don't see any president's faces. I only see yours." The last postcard arrived 2 days after we found out she wasn't coming back. It was from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. On the front was a picture of a beautiful blue lake surrounded by tall evergreens. On the back she had written, "Tomorrow I will be in Lewiston. I love you, my Salamanca tree." At last, Gramps said,
"I sure hate to get back on the road, but time's a-wastin'."
"Yes," I thought. "Yes, yes, yes." Gram settled back for a nap while I said a few thousand more prayers. The next thing I knew, Gramps was pulling off the road again.
"Look here," he said, "the Wisconsin Dells."
He drove into a vast parking area and said,
"Why don't you two go look around? I'm going to get a little shut-eye."
Gram and I poked our noses into an old fort and then sat on the grass watching a group of Native Americans dance and beat drums. My mother had not liked the term Native Americans. She thought it sounded primitive and stiff. She said, "My great-grandmother was a Seneca Indian, and I'm proud of it." She wasn't a Seneca Native American. Indian sounds much more brave and elegant. In school, our teacher told us we had to say Native American, but I agreed with my mother. Indian sounded much better. My mother and I liked this Indianness in our background. She said it made us appreciate the gifts of nature. It made us closer to the land. I lay back and closed my eyes, listening to the drums beat, rush, 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 and the dancers chant, hurry, hurry, hurry. Someone was jingling bells, too, and for a moment I thought of Christmas and sleigh bells. When I opened my eyes again, Graham was gone. I glanced around, trying to remember where we had parked the car. I looked through the crowd, back at the trees, over at the concession stand. "They've gone," I thought. "They've left me." I pushed through the people. The crowd was clapping, the drums were beating. I was all turned around and could not remember which way we had come. There were 3 signs indicating different parking areas. The drums thundered. I pushed further into the crowd of people who were now clapping louder in time with the drums. The Indians had formed 2 circles, one inside the other, and were hopping up and down. The men danced in the outer circle and wore feather headdresses and short leather aprons. On their feet were moccasins, and I thought again about Phoebe's message, "Don't judge a man until you've walked 2 moons in his moccasins." Inside the circle of men, the women in long dresses and ropes of beads had joined arms and were dancing around one older woman who was wearing a regular cotton dress. On her head was an enormous headdress which had slipped down over her forehead. I looked closer. The woman in the center was hopping up and down. On her feet were flat, white shoes. In the space between drumbeats, I heard her say, "Huzzah! Huzzah!" Chapter 11. Flinching. Early the next morning, we left Wisconsin and drove on, eating up the road through the lower rim of Minnesota. The land here was hilly and green, forests tucked in close beside the road, and the air smelled of pine.
"At last," Gramps said, "some scenery. I love a place that has scenery, don't you, Chickabiddy?"
I had not said anything about what had happened the day before, about being scared down to my very bones when I thought they had left me. I don't know what came over me.
Ever since my mother left us that April day, I suspected that everyone was going to leave one by one. I was glad to be able to go on with Phoebe's story, because when I was talking about Phoebe, I wasn't thinking about much else. "Did Phoebe get any more messages?" Graham asked. She did. The following Saturday, Phoebe and I were going to Mary Lou's again. As we left Phoebe's house, there on the front steps was another white envelope with a blue sheet of paper inside. The message was, "Everyone has his own agenda." Phoebe and I looked up and down the street. There was no sign of the message lever. Mary Lou thought the messages, this one and the other one, were intriguing. "How exciting," she said. "I wish someone would leave me messages." Phoebe thought the messages were spooky. It was not the words that bothered her, nothing too frightening there. It was the idea that someone was sneaking around and leaving them on her porch. She worried that someone was watching their house, waiting for the right moment to leave the message. Phoebe was a champion worrier. We tried to figure out what the message meant. "Okay," Phoebe said. "An agenda is a list of things to be discussed at a meeting." "So maybe it's for your dad," I suggested. "Does he go to meetings?" "Well, I guess," Phoebe said. "He's ever so busy all day long." "Maybe it's from his boss," Mary Lou said. "Maybe your father hasn't been conducting his meetings very well." "My father is very organized," Phoebe said. "What about the other message?" Mary Lou said. "Don't judge a man until you've walked 2 moons in his moccasins." "I know what it means," I said. "I've heard my father use it lots of times. I used to imagine that there were 2 moons sitting in a pair of Indian shoes, but my father said it means that you shouldn't judge someone until you've walked in their moccasins, until you've been in their shoes, in their place." "And your father says this often?" Phoebe said. "I know what you're thinking," I said, "but my father isn't creeping around leaving those messages. It isn't his handwriting." When Ben came into Mary Lou's room, she asked him what he thought it meant. He took a sheet of paper from her desk and quickly drew a cartoon. It was a little spooky, because what he drew was identical to what I used to imagine. A pair of Indian moccasins with 2 moons in them. "Maybe," Mary Lou said to Phoebe, "your father's being too quick to judge people at work. He needs to walk in their moccasins first." "My father does not judge too quickly," Phoebe said.
"You don't have to get defensive," Ben said.
"I am not getting defensive. I'm just telling you that my father does not judge too quickly." Later, we went to the drugstore. I thought it was going to be only me and Phoebe and Mary Lou going, but by the time we left the house, we had accumulated Tommy and Dougie as well. At the last minute, Ben said he was coming too. "I don't know how you can stand it," Phoebe said to Mary Lou.
"Stand what?"
Phoebe pointed to Tommy and Dougie, who were running around like wound-up toys, making airplane noises and train noises and zooming in between us and then running up ahead and falling over each other and crying and then leaping back up again and socking each other and chasing after bumblebees.
"I'm used to it," Mary Lou said. "My brothers are always doing beef-brain things."
Ben walked right behind me all the way, which made me nervous. I kept turning around to see what he was doing back there, but he was just strolling along, smiling. Tommy bashed into me, and when I started to fall backward, Ben caught me. He put his arms around my waist and held on to me, even after it was obvious that I was not going to fall. I could smell that funny grapefruit smell again and feel his face pressed up against my hair. "Let go," I said, but he didn't let go. I had an odd sensation, as if a little creature was crawling up my spine. It wasn't a horrible sensation, more light and tickly. I thought maybe he dropped something down my shirt.
"Let go,"
I said, and finally he did. It was at the drugstore that I got a little scared. Maybe I had been listening to Phoebe's tales of lunatics and axe murderers too much. Phoebe and I were looking at the magazines when I felt as if someone was watching us. I looked over to where Ben was standing, but he and Mary Lou were busy rummaging around in the chocolate bars.
The feeling did not go away. I turned the other way around, and there, on the far side of the store, was the nervous young man who had come to Phoebe's house. He was at the cash register paying for something, but he was staring at us while he was handing his money to the clerk. I nudged Phoebe.
"Oh, no," she said. "The lunatic!" Phoebe hustled over to Ben and Mary Lou. "Look, quick, it's the lunatic!"
"Where?"
"At the cash register."
"There's nobody there," Mary Lou said.
"Honest, he was there," Phoebe said. "I swear he was. Ask Sal."
"He was there," I said. Later, when we had left Mary Lou and were on our way to Phoebe's house, we heard someone running up behind us. Phoebe thought we were doomed. "If we get our heads bashed in and that lunatic leaves us here on the sidewalk," she said. I felt a hand on my shoulder, and I opened my mouth to scream, but nothing came out. My brain was saying, "Scream! Scream!" But my voice was completely shut off. It was Ben. He said,
"Did I scare you?"
"That wasn't very funny," Phoebe said.
"I'll walk home with you," he said, "just in case there are any lunatics around."
He had difficulty saying lunatic. On the way to Phoebe's house, Ben said some odd things. First, he said,
"Maybe you shouldn't call him a lunatic."
"And why not?" Phoebe said.
"Because a lunatic is... it means... it sounds like... oh, never mind."
He would not explain, and he seemed embarrassed to have mentioned this in the first place. Then he said to me,
"Don't people touch each other at your house?"
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"I just wondered," he said. "You flinch every time someone touches you."
"I do not."
"You do."
He touched my arm. I have to admit, my instinct was to flinch, but I caught myself. I pretended not to notice that his hand was resting there on my arm. That creature tickling my spine was back. He said, like a doctor examining a patient.
He removed his hand. "Where's your mother?"
I had not mentioned my mother to anyone, not even Phoebe, except for the one time Phoebe had asked about her, and I had only said she didn't live with us. Ben said,
"I saw your father once, but I've never seen your mother. Where is she?"
"She's in Idaho. Lewiston, Idaho."
"What's she doing there?" Ben said.
"I don't really feel like saying." It didn't occur to me to ask him where his mother was. He touched my arm again. When I flinched, he said,
"Ha! Gotcha!"
It bothered me what he had said. It occurred to me that my father didn't hug me as much anymore, and that maybe I was starting to flinch whenever anyone touched me. I wasn't always like that. We used to be a hugging family. As I walked along with Ben and Phoebe, I remembered a time when I was 9 or 10. My mother crawled into bed with me and snuggled close and said, "Let's build a raft and float away down a river." I used to think about that raft a lot, and I actually believed that one day we might build a raft and float away down a river together. But when she went to Lewiston, Idaho, she went alone. Ben touched Phoebe's arm. She flinched.
"Ha!" he said. "Gotcha! You're jumpy too, Phoebe."
And that, too, bothered me. I had already noticed how tense Phoebe's whole family seemed. How tidy, how respectable, how thumpingly stiff. Was I becoming like that? Why were they like that? A couple times I had seen Phoebe's mother try to touch Phoebe or Prudence or Mr. Winterbottom, but they all drew back from her. It was as if they had outgrown her. Had I been drawing away from my own mother? Did she have empty spaces left over? Was that why she left? When we reached Phoebe's driveway, Ben said,
"I guess you're safe now. I guess I'll go."
"Go ahead," Phoebe said. Mrs. Cadaver came screeching up to the curb in her yellow Volkswagen with her wild red witch hair flying all over the place. She waved at us and started pulling things out of the car and plopping them on the sidewalk.
"Who's that?" Ben asked.
"Mrs. Cadaver."
"Cadaver? Like dead body?"
"That's right."
"Hi, Sal,"
Mrs. Cadaver called.
She dumped a pile of lumpy bags on the sidewalk. Ben asked if she wanted any help.
"My, you're very polite," Mrs. Cadaver said, flashing her wild gray eyes.
"She scares me half to death," Phoebe said. "Don't go inside," she whispered to Ben.
"Why not?" he said, too loudly, because Mrs. Cadaver looked up and said, "What?"
"Oh, nothing," Phoebe said.
Mrs. Cadaver said, "Sal, do you want to come in?"
"I was just going to Phoebe's," I said, glad for an excuse. Phoebe's mother came to her front door.
"Phoebe, what are you doing? Are you coming in?"
We left Ben. As we were going in Phoebe's house, we saw Ben lift something off the sidewalk. It was a shiny new axe.
Phoebe's mother said, "Is that Mary Lou's brother? Was he walking you home? Where's Mary Lou?"
"I hate it when you ask me three questions in a row," Phoebe said. Through the window, we could see Ben lugging the axe up the front steps of Mrs. Cadaver's house. Phoebe called out, "Don't go in!" But when Mrs. Cadaver held the front door open, Ben disappeared inside.
"Phoebe, what are you doing?" her mother asked.
Then Phoebe pulled the envelope out of her pocket, the envelope containing the newest message. "I found this outside," Phoebe said. Mrs. Winterbottom opened the envelope carefully, as if it might contain a miniature bomb.
"Oh, sweetie," she said. "Who is it from? Who is it for? What does it mean?"
Phoebe explained what an agenda was.
"I know what an agenda is, Phoebe. I don't like this at all. I want to know who is sending these."
I was waiting for Phoebe to tell her about seeing the nervous young man at the drugstore, but Phoebe didn't mention it. A little later, we saw Ben leave Mrs. Cadaver's house. He appeared to be all in one piece. That day, when I got home, my father was in the garage tinkering with the car. He was leaning over the engine, and I couldn't see his face at first.
"Dad, what do you think it means if someone touches someone else and the person being touched flinches? Do you think it means that the person being touched is getting too stiff?"
Dad turned slowly around. His eyes were red and puffy. I think he had been crying. His hands and shirt were greasy, but when he hugged me, I didn't flinch. Chapter 12. The Marriage Bed. When I had first started telling Phoebe's story, Graham and Gramps sat quietly and listened. Gramps concentrated on the road, and Graham gazed out the window. Occasionally they interjected a "gol dang" or a "no kiddin'," but as I got farther into the story, they began to interrupt more and more. When I told about the message, "Everyone has his own agenda," Graham thumped on the dashboard and said,
"Isn't that the truth? Lordy, isn't that what it is all about?"
I said, "How do you mean?"
"Everybody is just walking along concerned with his own problems, his own life, his own worries, and we're all expecting other people to tune into our own agenda. Look at my worry. Worry with me. Step into my life. Care about my problems. Care about me."
Graham sighed. Gramp scratched his head.
"You turning into a philosopher or something?"
"Mind your own agenda," she said.
When I mentioned about Ben asking where my mother was and my saying that she was in Lewiston, but that I didn't want to elaborate, Graham and Gramps looked at each other. Gramps said,
"One time my father took off for 6 months and didn't tell a soul where he was going. When my best friend asked me where my father was, I hauled off and punched him in the jaw. My best friend, I punched him dang in the jaw."
"You never told me that," Graham said. "I hope he socked you back."
Gramps pointed to a gap in his teeth.
"See that? He knocks my tooth dang out."
And when I told Graham and Gramps about flinching when Ben touched me and about how I went home and found Dad in the garage, Graham unbuckled her seatbelt, turned all the way around, and leaned over the back of her seat. She took my hand and kissed it. Gramps said,
"Give her one for me, too."
And so Graham kissed my hand again. Several times when I described Phoebe's world of lunatics and axe murderers, Graham said,
"Just like Gloria. I swear to goodness, just exactly like Gloria."
Once, after she said this, Gramps got a dreamy look on his face, and Gramps said, "Quit that mooning over Gloria. I know what you're thinking."
Gramps said, "Hear that, Chickabiddy? This here gooseberry knows everything that runs through my head. Isn't she something?"
Just before we reached the South Dakota border, Gramps took a detour north because he had seen a sign advertising the Pipestone National Monument in Pipestone, Minnesota. On the sign was a picture of an Indian smoking a pipe.
"What do you want to go see an old Indian smoking a pipe for?"
Graham asked. She didn't like the term Native American any more than my mother did.
"I just do," Gramps said. "We might not ever get the chance again."
"To see an Indian smoking a pipe?"
Graham said. "Will it take very long?" I asked as the air screamed, "Hurry, hurry, hurry."
"Not too long, Chickabiddy. We've got to cool off our carburetors. These roads are taking the poop out of me."
The detour to Pipestone wound through a cool, dark forest, and if you closed your eyes and smelled the air, you could smell Bybanks, Kentucky. Pipestone was a small town. Everywhere we went, people were talking to each other, standing there talking, or sitting on a bench talking, or walking along the street talking. When we passed by, they looked up at us right into our faces and said, "Hi," or "Howdy." And although it sounds corny to say it, we felt right at home there. It was so like Bybanks, where everyone you see stops to say something because they know you and have known you their whole lives. We went to the Pipestone National Monument and saw Indians thunking away at the stone in the quarry. I asked one if he was a Native American, but he said, "No, I'm a person." I said, "But are you a Native American person?" He said, "No, I'm an American Indian person." I said, "So am I, in my blood." We watched other American Indian persons making pipes out of the stone. In the Pipe Museum, we learned more about pipes than any human being ought to know. In a little clearing outside the museum, an American Indian person was sitting on a tree stump smoking a long peace pipe. After watching him for about 5 minutes, Gramps asked if he could try it. The man passed Gramps the pipe, and Gramps sat down on the grass, took two puffs, and passed it to Graham. She didn't even blink. She took two puffs and passed it to me. There was a sweet, sticky taste on the end of the pipe. With the stem in my mouth, I gave it two little kisses, which is what it looked like Graham and Gramps had done. The smoke came into my mouth, and I held it there while I passed the pipe back. I held that smoke in my mouth while Graham and Gramps puffed some more. I was feeling slightly wang-doodled. I opened my mouth a wee bit, and a tiny stream of smoke curled out into the air. And when I saw that, for some reason, I was reminded of my mother. It didn't make any sense, but my brain was saying, "There goes your mother." And I watched the trail of smoke disappear into the air. In the shop attached to the Pipe Museum, Gramps bought two peace pipes. One was for him, and one was for me.
"It's not for smoking with," he said. "It's for remembering with."
That night, we stayed at Injun Joe's Peace Palace Motel. On a sign in the lobby, someone had crossed out "Injun" and written "Native American," so the whole sign read, "Native American Joe's Peace Palace Motel." In our room, the Injun Joe's embroidered on the towels had been changed with black marker to Indian Joe's. I wished everybody would just make up their minds. By now, I was used to staying in a room with Graham and Gramps. Every night, when they climbed into bed, they lay right beside each other on their backs, and Gramps said every single night,
"Well, this ain't our marriage bed, but it will do."
Probably the most precious thing in the whole world to Gramps, besides Graham, was their marriage bed. This is what he called their bed back home in Bybanks, Kentucky. One of the stories that Gramps liked to tell was about how he and all his brothers had been born in that bed, and all Graham and Gramps' own children had been born in that same bed. When Gramps tells this story, he starts with when he was 17 years old and living with his parents in Bybanks. That's when he met Graham. She was visiting her aunt who lived over the meadow from where Gramps lived.
"I was a wild thing then," Gramps said. "And I didn't stand still for any girl, I can tell you that."
They had to try to catch Gramps on the run. But when he saw Graham running in the meadow with her long hair as silky as a filly's, he was the one who was trying to do the catching.
"Talk about wild things. Your grandmother was the wildest, most untamed, most ornery and beautiful creature ever to grace this earth."
Gramps said that he followed her like a sick old dog for 22 days, and on the 23rd day, he marched up to her father and asked if he could marry her. Her father said,
"If you can get her to stand still long enough and if she'll have you, I guess you can."
When Gramps asked Graham to marry him, she said, "Do you have a dog?" Gramps said that yes, as a matter of fact, he had an old beagle named Sadie. Graham said, "And where does she sleep?" Gramps stumbled around a bit and said,
"To tell you the truth, she sleeps right next to me, but if we was to get married, I..."
"And when you come in the door at night," Graham said, "what does that dog do?" Gramps couldn't figure out what she was getting at, so he just told the truth.
"She jumps all over me, a-licking and a-howling."
"And then what do you do?" Graham said.
"Well, gosh,"
Gramps said. He did not like to admit it, but he said,
"I take her in my lap and pet her till she calms down, and sometimes I sing her a song. You're making me feel foolish."
"I don't mean to," she said. "You've told me all I need to know. I figure if you treat a dog that good, you'll treat me better. I figure if that old beagle Sadie loves you so much, I'll probably love you better. Yes, I'll marry you." They were married 3 months later. During that time between his proposal and their wedding day, Gramps and his father and brothers built a small house in the clearing behind the first meadow.
"We didn't have time," Gramps said, "to completely finish it. And there wasn't a single stick of furniture in it yet, but that didn't matter. We were going to sleep there on our wedding night all the same."
They were married in an aspen grove on a clear July day, and afterward, they and all their friends and relatives had a wedding supper on the banks of the river. During the supper, Gramps noticed that his father and two of his brothers were absent. He thought maybe they were planning a wet cheer, which is when the men kidnap the groom for an hour or so, and they all go out to the woods and share a bottle of whiskey. Before the end of the supper, his father and brothers came back, but they did not kidnap him for a wet cheer. Gramps was just as glad, he said, because he needed his wits about him that evening. At the end of the supper, Gramps picked up Graham in his arms and carried her across the meadow. Behind them, everyone was singing, "Oh, meet me in the tulips when the tulips do bloom." This is what they always sing at weddings when the married couple leaves. It is supposed to be a joke, as if Graham and Gramps were going away by themselves and might not reappear until the following spring when the tulips were in bloom. Gramps carried Graham all the way across the meadow and through the trees and into the clearing where their little house stood. He carried her in through the door, took one look around, and started to cry. The reason Gramps cried when he carried Graham into the house was that there, in the center of the bedroom, stood his own parents' bed. The bed that Gramps and each of his brothers had been born in. The bed his parents had always slept in. This was where his father and brothers had disappeared to during the wedding supper. They had been moving the bed into Graham and Gramps' new house. At the foot of the bed, wiggling and slurping, was Sadie, Gramps' old beagle dog. Gramps always ends this story by saying,
"That bed has been around my whole entire life, and I'm going to die in that bed, and then that bed will know everything there is to know about me."
So each night on our trip out to Idaho, Gramps patted the bed in the motel and said,
"Well, this ain't our marriage bed, but it will do."
While I lay in the next bed wondering if I would ever have a marriage bed like theirs. Chapter 13, Bouncing Berkway.
It was time to tell Grandma and Gramps about Mr. Berkway. Mr. Berkway was mighty strange. I didn't know what to make of him. I thought he might have a few squirrels in the attic of his brain. He was one of those energetic teachers who loved his subject half to death and leaped about the room dramatically, waving his arms and clutching his chest and whomping people on the back. He said, "Brilliant," and "Wonderful," and "Terrific." He was tall and slim, and his bushy black hair made him look wild, but he had enormous, deep, brown, cow-like eyes that sparkled all over the place. And when he turned these eyes on you, you felt as if his whole purpose in life was to stand there and listen to you and you alone. Midway through the first class, Mr. Berkway asked for everyone's summer journals. He flung himself up and down the aisles, receiving the journals as if they were manna from heaven. "Wonderful," he said to each journal giver. I was worried. I had no journal. On top of Mary Lou Finney's desk were six journals. Six. Mr. Berkway said, "Heaven's mercy, is it? Can it be Shakespeare?" He counted the journals. "Six! Brilliant! Magnificent!" Christy and Megan, two girls who had their own club called the GGP, whatever that meant, were whispering over on the other side of the room and casting malevolent looks in Mary Lou's direction. Mary Lou kept her hand on top of the journals as Mr. Berkway reached for them. In a low voice, she said, "I don't want you to read them." "What?" Mr. Berkway boomed. "Not read them?" The whole room was silent. Mr. Berkway scooped up Mary Lou's journals before she could even blink. He said, "Don't be silly. Brilliant. Thank you." Another girl, Beth Ann, looked as if she might cry. Phoebe was sending me messages with her eyebrows that indicated that she was not too pleased either. I think they were all hoping that Mr. Berkway was not actually going to read these journals. Mr. Berkway went around the whole room snatching journals. Alex Cheevy's journal was covered with baseball stickers. Christie's and Megan's were slathered over with pictures of male models. The cover of Ben's was a cartoon of a boy with a normal boy's head, but the arms and legs were pencils, and out of the tips of the hands and feet were dribbles of words. When he got to Phoebe's desk, Mr. Berkway lifted up her plain journal and peeked inside. Phoebe was trying to slide down in her chair. "I didn't write much," Phoebe said. "In fact, I can hardly remember what I wrote about at all." By the time Mr. Berkway got to me, my heart was clobbering around so hard I thought it might leap straight out of my chest. "Deprived child," he said. "You didn't have a chance to write a journal." "I'm new." "New? How blessed," he said. "There's nothing in this whole wide world that is better than a new person." "So I didn't know about the journals." "Not to worry," Mr. Berkway said. "I'll think of something." I wasn't sure what that meant. I thought maybe he would give me a whole lot of extra homework or something. For the rest of the day, you could see little groups of people asking each other, "Did you write about me?" I was very glad I hadn't written anything. For a while, we didn't hear any more about the journals. We had absolutely no idea all the trouble they were going to cause. Chapter 14. The Rhododendron. One Saturday, I was at Phoebe's again. Her father was golfing, and her mother was running errands. Mrs. Winterbottom had read out a long list to us of where she would be in case we needed her. If we heard any noises at all, we were supposed to call the police immediately. "After you call the police," Mrs. Winterbottom said, "call Mrs. Cadaver. I think she's home today. I'm sure she would come right over." "Oh, sure," Phoebe whispered to me. "That's about the last person I would call." Phoebe imagined that every noise was the lunatic sneaking in or the message leaver creeping up to drop off another anonymous note. She was so jumpy that I began to feel uneasy, too. After her mother left, Phoebe said,
Mrs. Cadaver works odd hours, doesn't she? Sometimes she works every night for a week, straggling home when most people are waking up, but sometimes she works during the day.
She's a nurse, so I guess she works different shifts, I said.
That day, Mrs. Cadaver was home, puttering around her garden. We saw her from Phoebe's bedroom window. Actually, puttering is not the best word. What she was doing was more like slogging and slashing. Mrs. Cadaver hacked branches off of trees and hauled these to the back of her lot where she lumped them into a pile of branches that she had hacked off last week. I told you she was as strong as an ox, Phoebe said. Next, Mrs. Cadaver slashed and sliced at a pitiful rose bush that had been trying to creep up the side of her house. Then she sheared off the tops of the hedge that borders Phoebe's yard. She moved on to a rhododendron bush, which she was poking and prodding when a car pulled into her driveway. A tall man with bushy black hair leaped out, and seeing her, he practically skipped back to where she was. They hugged each other.
"Oh, no," Phoebe said. The man with the bushy black hair was Mr. Berkway, our English teacher.
Mrs. Cadaver pointed to the rhododendron bush and then at the axe, but Mr. Berkway shook his head. He disappeared into the garage and returned with two shovels. Then he and Mrs. Cadaver gouged and prodded and tunneled around in the dirt until the poor old rhododendron flopped onto its side. They lugged the bush to the opposite side of the yard where there was a mound of dirt, and they replanted the bush.
"Maybe there's something hidden under the bush," Phoebe said.
"Like what?"
"Like Mr. Cadaver, as I told you before. Maybe Mr. Berkway helped her chop up her husband and bury him, and maybe they were getting worried and decided to disguise the spot with a rhododendron bush."
I must have looked skeptical. Phoebe said,
"Sal, you never can tell. And Sal, I don't think you or your father should go over there anymore."
I certainly agreed with her on that one. Dad and I had been there two nights earlier, and I had hardly been able to sit still. I started noticing all these frightening things in Margaret's house. Creepy masks, old swords, books with titles like The Murders in the Rue Morgue and The Skull and the Hatchet. Margaret cornered me in the kitchen and said,
"So what has your father told you about me?"
"Nothing," I said.
"Oh,"
she seemed disappointed. My father's behavior was always different at Margaret's. At home, I would sometimes find him sitting on his bed staring at the floor or reading through old letters or gazing at the photo album. He looked sad and lonely. But at Margaret's, he would smile and sometimes even laugh, and once she touched his hand and he let her hand rest there on top of his, I didn't like it. I didn't want my father to be sad, but at least when he was sad, I knew he was remembering my mother. So when Phoebe suggested that my father and I should not go to Margaret's, I was quite willing to agree with that notion. When Phoebe's mother came home from running all her errands, she looked terrible. She was sniffling and blowing her nose. Phoebe said that we were going to do our homework. Upstairs, I said, maybe we should have helped her put away the groceries.
She likes to do all that by herself, Phoebe said.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure, Phoebe said. I've lived here my whole life, haven't I?
She looked as if she'd been crying. Maybe something is wrong. Maybe something is bothering her.
Don't you think she would say so, then?
Maybe she's afraid to, I said. I wondered why it was so easy for me to see that Phoebe's mother was worried and miserable, but Phoebe couldn't see it, or if she could, she was ignoring it. Maybe she didn't want to notice. Maybe it was too frightening a thing. I wondered if this is how it had been with my mother. Were there things I didn't notice? Later that afternoon, when Phoebe and I went downstairs, Mrs. Winterbottom was talking with Prudence.
"Do you think I lead a tiny life?" she asked.
"How do you mean?" Prudence said as she filed her nails. "Do we have any nail polish remover?"
Phoebe's mother retrieved a bottle of nail polish remover from the bathroom.
"Oh," Prudence said. "Before I forget, do you think you could sew up the hem on my brown skirt so I could wear it tomorrow?"
"Oh, please." Prudence tilted her head to the side, tugged at her hair in exactly the same way Phoebe does, and smooshed up her mouth into a little pout. "Doesn't Prudence know how to sew?" I asked. "Of course she does," Phoebe said. "Why?"
"I was just wondering why she doesn't sew her own skirt."
"Sal, you're becoming very critical." Before I left Phoebe's that day, Mrs. Winterbottom handed Prudence her brown skirt with the newly sewn hem, and all the way home I wondered about Mrs. Winterbottom and what she meant about living a tiny life. If she didn't like all that baking and cleaning and jumping up to get bottles of nail polish remover and sewing hems, why did she do it? Why didn't she tell them to do some of these things themselves? Maybe she was afraid there would be nothing left for her to do. There would be no need for her, and she would become invisible and no one would notice. When I got home that day, my father handed me a package.
"It's from Margaret," he said.
"What is it?"
"Well, I don't know. Why don't you open it?"
Inside was a blue sweater. I packed it back in the box and went upstairs. My father followed me.
"Sal? Sal, do you like it?"
"I don't want it," I said.
"She was just trying to... She likes you."
"I don't care if she likes me or not," I said. My father stood there looking around the room.
"I want to tell you something about Margaret," he said.
"Well, I don't want to hear it."
I was feeling so completely ornery.
When my father left the room, I could still hear my own voice saying, "I don't want to hear it." I sounded exactly like Phoebe. Chapter 15. A Snake Has a Snack. It was hotter than blazes in South Dakota. In Sioux Falls, Gramps took off his shirt. Passing Mitchell, Graham unbuttoned her dress down to her waist. Just beyond Chamberlain, Gramps took a detour to the Missouri River. He parked the car beneath a tree overlooking a sandy bank. Graham and Gramps kicked off their shoes. It was quiet and hot, hot, hot. All you could hear was a crow calling somewhere upriver and the distant sound of cars along the highway. The hot air pressed against my face and my hair was like a hot, heavy blanket draped on my neck and back. It was so hot you could smell the heat baking the stones and dirt along the bank. Graham pulled her dress up over her head, and Gramps undid his buckle and let his pants slide to the ground. They started kicking water at each other and scooping it up and letting it run down their faces. They walked into where it was knee-deep and sat down.
"Come on, Chickabiddy," Gramps called.
Graham said, "It's delicious."
I gazed up and down the river, not a soul in sight. The water looked cool and clear.
Graham and Gramps sat there in the river, grinning away. I waded in and sat down. It was nearly heaven, with that cool water rippling and a high, clear sky all around us and trees waving along the banks. My hair floated all around me. My mother's hair had been long and black like mine, but a week before she left, she cut it. My father said to me, "Don't cut yours, Sal. Please don't cut yours."
My mother said, "I knew you wouldn't like it if I cut mine."
My father said, "I didn't say anything about yours."
"But I know what you're thinking," she said.
"I loved your hair, sugar," he said.
I saved her hair. I swept it up from the kitchen floor and wrapped it in a plastic bag and hid it beneath the floorboards of my room. It was still there, along with the postcard she sent. As Graham, Gramps, and I sat in the Missouri River, I tried not to think of the postcards. I tried to concentrate on the high sky and the cool water. It would have been perfect except for that ornery crow calling away, "Car, car, car."
"Will we be here long?" I asked. The boy came out of nowhere. Gramps saw him first and whispered,
"Get behind me, Chickabiddy. You too," he said to Graham.
The boy was about 15 or 16 with shaggy dark hair. He wore blue jeans and no shirt, and his chest was brown and muscular. In his hand, he held a long bowie knife, its sheath fastened to his belt. He stood next to Gramps' pants on the bank.
I thought of Phoebe and knew that if she were here, she would be warning us that the boy was a lunatic who would hack us all to pieces. I was wishing we had never stopped at the river and that my grandparents would be more cautious, maybe even a little more like Phoebe, who saw danger everywhere. As the boy stared at us, Gramp said, "Howdy." The boy said, "This here's private property." Gramps looked all around. "Is it? I didn't see any signs." "It's private property." "Why, heck," Gramp said, "this here's a river. I never heard of no river being private property." The boy picked up Gramps' pants and slid his hand into a pocket. "This land where I'm standing is private property." I was frightened of the boy and wanted Gramps to do something, but Gramps looked cool and calm. He sounded as if he hadn't a care in the world, but I knew that he was worried by the way he kept inching in front of me and Graham. I felt around the riverbed, pulled up a flat stone, and skimmed it across the water. The boy watched the stone, counting the skips. A snake flickered along the bank and slid into the water. "See that tree?" Gramps said. He pointed to an old willow leaning into the water where the boy stood. "I see it," the boy said, sliding his hand into another of Gramps' pockets. Gramps said, "See that knot hole? Watch what this here chickabiddy can do to a knot hole." Gramps winked at me. The veins in his neck were standing out. You could practically see the blood rushing through them. I felt around the riverbed and pulled up another flat, jagged rock. I had done this a million times in the swimming hole in Bybanks. I pulled my arm back and tossed the rock straight at the tree. One edge embedded itself in the knot hole. The boy stopped rummaging through Gramps' pockets and eyed me. Gramps said, "Oh!" and flailed at the water. She reached down, pulled up a snake, and gave Gramps a puzzled look. "It's a water moccasin, isn't it?" she said. "It's a poisonous one, isn't it?" The snake slithered and wriggled, straining toward the water. "I do believe it has had a snack out of my leg." She stared hard at Gramps. The boy stood on the bank holding Gramps' wallet. Gramps scooped up Graham and carried her out of the water. "Would you mind dropping that thing?" he said to Graham, who was still clutching the snake. To me, he said, "Get on out of there, chickabiddy." As Gramps put Graham on the riverbank, the boy came and knelt beside her. "I'm sure glad you have that knife," Gramps said, reaching for it. As he made a slit in Graham's leg across the snake bite, blood trickled down her ankle. I grabbed Graham's hand as she stared up at the sky. Gramps knelt to suck out the wound, but the boy said, "Here, I'll do it." The boy placed his mouth against Graham's bloody leg. He sucked and spit, sucked and spit. Graham's eyelids fluttered. "Can you point us to a hospital?" Gramps said. The boy nodded as he spit. Gramps and the boy carried Graham to the car and settled her in the back seat while I snatched their clothes from the riverbank. We placed Graham's head on my lap and her feet on the boy's lap, and all the while the boy continued sucking and spitting. In between, he gave directions to the hospital. Graham held on to my hand. Gramps, still in his boxer shorts and dripping wet, carried Graham into the hospital. The boy's mouth hovered over her leg the whole time, sucking and spitting. Graham spent the night in the hospital. In the waiting room, the boy from the riverbank sprawled in a chair. I offered him a paper towel. "You've got blood on your mouth," I said. I handed him a $50 bill. "My grandfather said to give you this. That's all the cash he has right now. He said to tell you thanks. He'd come out himself, but he doesn't want to leave her." He looked at the $50 bill in my hand. "I don't need it." "You don't have to stay," I said. He glanced around the waiting room. "I know it." He looked away and then said, "I like your hair." "I was thinking of cutting it." "Don't." I sat down beside him. He said,
"It wasn't really private property."
I didn't think so. Later, when I went in to see Graham, she was all tucked up in bed, pale and sleepy. Next to her on the narrow bed, Gramps was lying on top of the covers, stroking her hair. A nurse came in and made him get off the bed. He had by now put his pants on, but he looked a wreck. I asked Graham how she was feeling. She blinked her eyes a few times and said, "Piddles."
Gramp said, "They must have given her something. She doesn't know what she's saying."
I leaned down and whispered in her ear, "Graham, don't leave us." "Piddles," Graham said. When the nurse left the room, Gramps climbed back on top of the bed and lay down next to Graham. He patted the bed.
"Well,"
he said,
"this ain't our marriage bed, but it'll do."
Chapter 16. The Singing Tree. Graham was released from the hospital the next morning, mainly because she was so ornery. Gramps wanted her to stay another day, but Graham climbed out of bed and said, "Where's my underwear?"
"I guess this cantankerous woman is getting out of here," Gramps said.
I think fear had made us all a little cantankerous. I had spent the night in the waiting room. Gramps offered to get me a motel room, but I was afraid that if I left the hospital, I would never see Graham again. The boy we had met at the river curled up in an armchair, but I don't think he slept either. Once he used the telephone, I heard him say, "Yeah, I'll be home in the morning. I'm with some friends." The boy woke me up at 6 o'clock and said Graham was much better. He handed me a piece of paper.
"That's my address in case you ever want to write or anything, but I'd understand if you didn't."
I opened the paper. "What's your name?" He smiled.
"Oh, yeah, right."
He took the paper and added his name. "Tom Fleet."
"See ya," he said.
As we were checking out of the hospital, I asked if we should call my father. Gramp said,
"Well, now, chickabiddy, I thought about that, but it's only going to make him worry. Do you think we could wait to call him when we get to Idaho?"
Gramps was right, but I was disappointed. I was ready to call my father. I wanted very much to hear his voice, but I was also afraid that I might ask him to come and get me. Outside the hospital, I heard the warbling of a bird, and it was such a familiar warble that I stopped and listened for its source. Bordering the parking lot was a rim of poplars. The sound was coming from somewhere in the top of one of those trees, and I thought instantly of the singing trees in Bybanks. Next to my favorite sugar maple tree beside the barn is a tall aspen. When I was younger, I heard the most beautiful bird song coming from the top of that tree. It was not a call, it was a true bird song with trills and warbles. I stood beneath that tree for the longest time, hoping to catch sight of the bird who was singing such a song. I saw no bird, only leaves waving in the breeze. The longer I stared up at the leaves, the more it seemed that it was the tree itself that was singing. Every time I passed that tree, I listened. Sometimes it sang, sometimes it did not, but from then on I always called it the singing tree. The morning after my father learned that my mother was not coming back, he left for Lewiston, Idaho. Graham and Gramps came to stay with me. I had pleaded to go along, but my father said he didn't think I should have to go through that. That day, I climbed up into the maple and watched the singing tree, waiting for it to sing. I stayed there all day and on into the early evening. It did not sing. At dusk, Gramps placed 3 sleeping bags at the foot of the tree, and he, Graham, and I slept there all night. The tree did not sing. In the hospital parking lot, Graham heard the song, too. "Oh, Salamanca," she said, "a singing tree." She pulled at Gramps' sleeve. "Oh, it's a good sign, don't you think?" As we swept on across South Dakota toward the Badlands, the whispers no longer said, "Hurry, hurry," or "Rush, rush." They now said, "Slow down, slow down." I could not figure this out. It seemed some sort of warning, but I did not have too much time to think about it as I was busy telling about Phoebe. Chapter 17. In the Course of a Lifetime. A few days after Phoebe and I had seen Mr. Berkway and Mrs. Cadaver whacking away at the rhododendron, I walked home with Phoebe after school. She was as crotchety and sullen as a 3-legged mule, and I was not quite sure why. She had been asking me why I had not said anything to my father about Mrs. Cadaver and Mr. Berkway, and I told her that I was waiting for the right time. "Your father was over there yesterday," Phoebe said. "I saw him. He better watch out. What would you do if Mrs. Cadaver chopped